respectively will note their appearance, and if you wish to reserve any time, please so state. If you wish to reserve any time, please so state.
Good afternoon, Justices and Counsel for the State. May it please the Court, my name is Audrey Conway, and along with Violet Rodolfo and the Clark County Public Defender's Office, I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Frank Zanini. And we would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. This case is a direct appeal of a jury verdict. Mr. Zanini was convicted of 2 counts of sexual assault on a minor under 14 and 1 count under 16. Of the remaining sex assault counts, jurors acquitted Mr. Zanini of 2 counts, and they could not reach a verdict on the 12 remaining counts. Frank was sentenced to 25 years to life on count 1, 25 years to life on count 2, consecutive, and 20 years to life on count 3. Again, consecutive to counts 1 and 2. He will serve a minimum of 70 years.
Counsel, we are very familiar with those things. You might want to use your time more expeditiously as of the point you wish to argue this morning or this afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case hinged upon the credibility of the complaining witness, Frank's niece, whom I will refer to as Jay during this argument. Jay undoubtedly had a very troubled childhood. Her biological father went to prison for molesting her when she was 5. She had a history of relationships with adult men. She had a history of recanting certain allegations against some of these men. And in fact, she recanted the allegations in the instant case in the months before trial. However, as much as the verdicts revealed jurors' manifest difficulties with Jay's credibility, the primary issue I would like to address with the court today is one that instead implicates the credibility of the defense and the defense attorneys specifically. Before this office represented Frank, he was represented by a private attorney who entered into plea negotiations on his behalf. On December 3, 2008, Frank unconditionally waived his preliminary hearing in anticipation of accepting a plea deal. Frank ultimately changed his mind, and the state reinstated the original charges by way of amended information on January 8, 2009. In the intervening weeks between Frank waiving his preliminary hearing and the reinstatement of the original charges, Frank consulted at length with family members about whether he was doing the right thing. In a series of calls from the jail, he discussed his hopes for sentencing. In one call, he advised a family member that if the accuser, Jay, were to write a letter, he would have a better chance of getting probation and counseling. During this month, he made numerous statements related entirely to the plea deal and his desire to seek lenience at sentencing. The defense specifically objected to the admission of any type of evidence that referenced sentencing, a plea, negotiations of any type. The court granted the defense request in part. The court ruled that all references to a plea or to negotiations would be excluded, although the court allowed the state to introduce some evidence showing that Frank had asked Jay to write a letter on his behalf and that he had discussed that with family members. Ultimately, however, jurors heard not one but 2 explicit references to the fact that Frank had contemplated a plea. The first reference occurred when the prosecutor was conducting Jay's redirect examination. Jay had come to the public defender's office and recanted these allegations against Frank several months before trial. These statements were reported and made in the presence of defense attorney Ms. Rodosta and our investigator. After she recanted the allegations, Ms. Rodosta gave Jay a general idea of what would happen next. She advised that although the parties might work out a negotiation, the charges would not be dismissed. Despite the court's ruling that no mention should be made of pleas or negotiations, the prosecutor asked Jay about Ms. Rodosta's reference, and I quote, "Did Ms. Rodosta tell you that based upon what was going on, and after several paragraphs, it finally, you know, we'll try to do what we can to prevent the trial from going forward, to work out a negotiation. But the truth of the matter is, they're not going to simply dismiss the charges." The defense immediately objected and moved for a mistrial. The defense argued that once jurors heard that Frank's attorneys had contemplated the possibility of a plea deal and the possibility of negotiating this case, the defense had essentially lost all credibility in turning around and then arguing for his acquittal and arguing for his innocence. The court denied the motion for a mistrial. The next morning, the defense renewed the motion again, and the state argued that that question was relevant to reveal improper influence and pressure on Jay from the defense attorney, Ms. Rodosta. At key point I would like to highlight for this court is that when the statement was made by Ms. Rodasta, Jay had already recanted. She had already taken back these allegations. This was not before the interview. This occurred after she recanted every single allegation against Frank. This statement explicitly advised jurors that defense attorneys were looking for a way to prevent the trial from going forward and to work out a negotiation in the case. This implication carries significant prejudice to the defense. But this was not the only time jurors heard a specific reference to the possibility of negotiating this case. A second reference occurred during the playing of a jail call between Frank and his nephew, Ronnie, who is Jay's older brother. Although the court had ordered, again, that all references to plea negotiations be redacted from the CD, the actual CD that was played contained these references. Although the court's order was rather explicit, jurors still heard Frank tell Ronnie the following, and again, I quote.
Counsel, as to that CD that was played, did defense have an opportunity to review that, or were they offered an opportunity to review that before it was played?
Absolutely, Justice Douglas, yes. Ronnie.
And did they review it?
What happened was the redactions were made on the morning of trial, and it was a very rushed opportunity, but they did have the opportunity to sit outside and to listen to the CD being played. Somehow, either the defense attorney did not hear that reference, the wrong CD was played, there was some mix-up, or the state had perhaps inadvertently failed to redact that particular portion, and nobody caught it until it was played during trial. To the extent that we had the opportunity to hear that and somehow missed it, you know, there is an argument there that we were certainly partially at fault for not hearing that. But as soon as it was played, we immediately objected and moved for a mistrial. What jurors heard on the call was, I'm hoping to get it taken care of tomorrow with the plea, hoping to get it to the one charge and house arrest, and some guy got house arrest pending sentencing. The court agreed that the content of this call referenced negotiations, a plea, reduced charges, sentencing, but again, the court denied the mistrial motion. We are not suggesting that this was a deliberate inclusion of excluded evidence on the part of the state, because it was played for the defense attorney before trial. However, the court erred in denying the mistrial motion. In Mann v. State, this court overturned a conviction based upon the public policy underlying NRS 48125 and the prohibition on the use of plea-related statements by the state. This court rejected the state's position that the statute should be strictly construed to cover only formal offers to plead and pleas themselves. This court instead held that all plea-related statements should be excluded. The fact that Frank was scheduled to enter a plea of guilty at one point and had hoped to get house arrest pending sentencing had no relevance to the instant case, but resulted in substantial prejudice to the defense. At the point when Frank made this statement, he had taken a deal to plead to a lesser offense with a 10-year prison sentence to avoid the very real risk of the 70 years that he's serving right now. But we cannot expect jurors to know or understand the context of that type of negotiation. Jurors heard from both Frank and from his lawyer that a plea deal had been contemplated in this case. The presumption of innocence was greatly undermined, and this constitutes reversible error. It is also our position that the court erred in denying the defense motion to exclude all references to probation and counseling from these calls, as well as to any potential sentence. Every single time Frank mentioned these topics, it was in the context of having waived his preliminary hearing, he was right before sentencing, and his prior attorney had advised him that a judge may look favorably upon a letter written by the accuser when she imposes sentence. So Frank's discussions with his family members about the possibility of such a letter should not have been used against him, where this evidence was far more prejudicial than probative. The state argued that this evidence constituted consciousness of guilt, but these statements were not truly consciousness of guilt type of evidence. The state also contended that all of these statements amounted to pressure on Jay to recant. But this position ignores the actual procedural posture of the case at the time the statements were made. In December 2008, when all of these conversations took place, the case had been negotiated, and Frank was focused solely on sentencing. The state argued, however, and the court agreed, that these statements constituted consciousness of guilt. In reality, a person who has taken a deal and who is discussing a potential sentence with family members will always find himself sounding guilty in one way or another because he has taken a deal at that point and he's focused solely on sentencing. The only way to prevent the state from using this evidence, apparently, is if we advise our clients that they cannot discuss the topic of sentencing with any of their family members prior to sentencing. That if they're even considering a deal like this with a substantial prison sentence and potentially a life tail, that they're on their own, that they can only speak to their attorneys, but they cannot speak to anybody else. Otherwise, everything they say will be deemed consciousness of guilt evidence and used against them. And another fact I'd like to highlight for the court is that the so-called pressure on Jay theory that the state advanced, it may have had some legitimacy with some of the statements on the call. There were statements where he was encouraging family members to have Jay write this letter or to come and talk to the attorneys. Those incidents did occur. Those instances, however, are separate from the evidence that we're talking about now, where there were specific references to pleas, to sentencing, to negotiation. This was incredibly prejudicial, and to expect the defense attorneys, after both of these references came in, to stand in front of jurors and argue, to look them in the eye and argue for acquittal and argue for Frank's innocence, is completely unreasonable. What we would seek is a ruling from this court to the effect that none of this evidence is admissible. None of it is relevant. In the context of a person who has taken a plea deal, who has taken a negotiated sentence, and who is talking about an upcoming sentencing and his hopes for what might happen at that sentencing, we would like to see a ruling from this court to the effect that this is all far more prejudicial than probative, and there's a significantly high hurdle that the state must meet before a court can even consider admitting this type of evidence at trial. And if the court doesn't have any questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Please, the court, counsel. I'm going to go directly to the issue of the plea negotiation that's been addressed already. The first and foremost point, there was no evidence of plea negotiation offered in this case by the state. It is correct that Judge Kadish ruled it wouldn't come in. The state didn't oppose it. It clearly is the law that evidence of a plea or negotiations or statement related thereto are inadmissible by everyone, regardless of what happens. They're not good for impeachment, they're not good for anything. But that never came in at this trial. And the appellant's brief inaccurately states that Judge Kadish ruled anything different. In fact, at every stage, each of the statements that came in, she specifically found, I don't believe it's plea negotiation, but in an abundance of caution. And quite frankly, the state's position was, again, not plea negotiations, but if defense has a problem with it, we'll roll over. We'll take it out. We'll strike it. You want a curative instruction? On both occasions, they were offered that. In both cases, they declined. First, going to, with respect to Ms. Rodas' statement, this case had a tortured history. Back at the time of the preliminary hearing, the evidence would come out. And again, this all was brought out after cross-examination. The victim initially testifies. She testifies regarding the abuse at the hands of her uncle from the ages of 8 to 15, that this has happened. It's on cross. It's brought out that she did, in fact, recant a couple months prior to trial. Only then did we bring in evidence that, number one, she didn't come to the preliminary hearing right away. Number one, she didn't show up. Her grandmother showed up without her. I specifically had to send someone home to drag her to court because she was refusing to come to court. And that's important because that preliminary hearing was 12-3, December 3rd of 2008, and defense would have you believe that on that particular day, the defendant was coming in, he's making all these statements pursuant to his intention to take this deal. The deal of one count of lewdness with a 10-to-life sentence. No probation option, no option of anything else. None of these conversations had anything to do with law enforcement. They had nothing to do with the state of Nevada. Nobody in a position of doing any negotiations. And they also, inaccurately, I believe, and I know that these CDs were submitted as record on appeal, but if I may just put the statements that they've given in context to what the jury actually heard and what they're talking about and trying to argue to this court is somehow plea negotiating appropriate, This call on December 2nd, 2008, again, that's the night before the preliminary hearing in this case, when he allegedly was going to waive his prelim with his subjective intent of entering into some deal with the state. He calls, and the phone call is made to his wife at the time, Margie. Call my blank mother, it is actually, after this phone call. Tell my mom that her son is effed because of her granddaughter and her bullshit, and that the only way everything's going to work out is if she recants her story tomorrow. Basically, they told me, if she doesn't recant her story tomorrow, I am fucking screwed. That's the tone of the entire conversation that's going on, that they're trying to somehow say has anything remotely related to plea negotiations. He goes on further, about the only thing that might be possible, if she doesn't show up, or she recants her story, if she doesn't show up, they'll just postpone it for however long, and then postpone it again. And I think the third time, if she doesn't show up, then they'll move on, or whatever, I don't know. But she needs to recant her story, or my life is over. He goes on, call my mother, tell her what I said. And for your information, it was his mother who was responsible to bring the child to court. His mother was the legal mother of the child and biological grandmother of the child as well, who at that point was supportive of her son, the defendant in the case. Further says, tell his mom, tell her she doesn't have to be there at 8 o'clock. That's only so they can prep her. And guess what? She wasn't. She didn't bring the kid. She left the kid home, and it wasn't until we forced her to go and bring Jay into court that anything happened. So they're trying to claim that conversation somehow had anything to do with plea negotiations, that he somehow the next day intended to enter a plea. He intended nothing of the sort. Number one, statements to a mother or a wife or anybody else about how to basically beat the case is what he's talking about, to pressure the kid, tell her to recant. Never once does he in that tape say, tell her to tell the truth. The word is recant. And that's what's in all of these statements. He never once says, hey, tell Jamie to tell the truth about what happened. Tell her that, you know, this, she needs to come clean. He says, recant, tell her not to show. Call number 2, 1215-08. Now, remember, he never entered into a plea in this case at all. It's clear from this he had no subjective intent under the current case law to enter into a plea, and that none of this was intended as negotiation, but was intended as coercive tactics to either get a better deal or to get the case dumped entirely. But nothing legal. It was full dissuading coercion with respect to the victim. The second call is to Ronnie. It's to his, Zanini treated him like a son. He was actually the victim's brother who was supportive of the defendant and would ultimately be the one, evidence suggested, was the one mostly responsible for a recant because he wanted the defendant or the appellant to come home and take care of him. He was sitting around living the life, not doing anything, and once the defendant was taken out of the house or the appellant was taken out of the house, it wasn't so pleasant anymore. So he calls Ronnie, they do a little back and forth, and then they're talking about this letter, and Judge Kadish ruled that the letter could come in because of the context. Again, it wasn't he'd already pled and she's trying to get some letter together for sentencing, number one. It wasn't to his attorney, to the state. It wasn't in furtherance of negotiations. There were no negotiations. He didn't intend there to be negotiations. Other than, I guess, if you were to argue that he was trying to get a better negotiation by his coercive tactics. And so Judge Kadish immediately recognized that his letters requesting probation and with respect to punishment and leaning on his sister to do that had no protection under the law protecting plea negotiation conversations. What he says is about telling her to rewrite the letter, and he says, the appellant says to Ronnie, but the thing is, you've got to tell her what she needs to do is to tell the DA, this is what I want. This is the punishment I want him to get, and if you don't give him that, then I am not going to be a witness. I'm going to be a witness for him, not against him. Goes on, she has to stick to it. If she says that, you know, no matter what she says or how she threatens you, and the reference is to me, to Mary Kay, the state, she's got to stick to it. I am really hoping to get everything straightened out and taken care of tomorrow, put in the plea or whatever, something smaller, something than the word life in it. That does come in, and that's the statement that they're talking about. But that's the full context. It's not with respect to a plea. It's with respect to tell her this is what I want, this is what. And it's not even, there was no plea contemplated. There was no conversation with the state. There was never going to be any probation, and that was not his intent. His intent was tell her not to do it. And with respect to what the plea is, I mean, it's not even technically an offer to plead to anything, which is kind of what the statute contemplates. Having said that, Justice Sotomayor are correct that in an abundance of caution, because when we do redaction, it's hard. And, you know, you've been in trial. We had 300 phone calls that we were listening to. And so I specifically pulled Ms. Roundtree and Ms. Rodasta out into the hallway and said, here's what I got. I don't think I, you know, I narrowed it down first to 8 calls. And then we narrowed it down. We're looking at mostly these 3. And here's the portions of it as redacted, I believe, in compliance with the court order regarding plea negotiations. We sat down together and listened to that. There was no mistake. That was a CD I had. I had them listen to it. I took it from there, and it was marked and admitted, and that's the exhibit that we have here today. Having said that, if they had, I don't see where it's objectionable. Again, it is clearly not protected by the statute protecting offers of plea or plea negotiation or statements when you're telling your brother to go lean on your sister so that I can get off. Basically, the tenor is for something I did. That can't be protected. Having said that, the state didn't care. We said, you want it stricken? The judge said, I don't believe it violates the plea negotiation rule that I set down. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But you know what? You want it out. You want to move to strike. You want a curative instruction. We'll make a curative instruction. Defense declined and chose not to do that. And so it is what it is. But the rest of that, literally that one little portion, the rest of it just continues on. Don't forget, talk to her tomorrow morning and tell her all the shit I said. And that's where he goes with that.
From the state standpoint then, I mean, what you've been giving us, which is a total flip of what has been offered previously, the state had never put a plea deal on the table. It was, in essence, if there was a plea coming, it was strictly coming from the defense side to the state, but not the state offering.
There was a plea offered on prelim day, but the plea was, it wasn't a sentence-sensitive plea. It was a mandatory 10 to life. So it wasn't anything that you could write all the letters you wanted to on it. It was a stipulated life minimum 10 on a lewdness. So, no, and again, that was never contemplated, so it wouldn't have had any place. It was strictly trying to get her to say, you either give them what I'm telling you to give them, or I'm not going to cooperate, which isn't legal, quite frankly. And a statute can't protect illegal conversation like that. It just would be an absurdity. Even after Justice on December 16th, 2008, to the extent going back to, he goes back telling Ronnie about going to his attorney and getting his stuff, evidencing no subjective intent to be in negotiations. I don't give an F if you just talk to his secretary, tell her I want everything, the defense, everything that both sides had. I want a copy of everything the prosecution has. I want a copy of everything that we have. I've been asking for it for 2 weeks now. I haven't got shit. Ronnie goes on to tell him that Don, his attorney, tells them that there's no way you're going to get probation. That's the way he told her. So she put it in the letter and everything, but he said there's no way you're going to get probation. Zanini says, yeah, if she refuses to testify, then they got no case. She can always tell them, you know, hey, they know, they made me effing do that shit or whatever. You know, hey, well, you know, I blamed him, but it wasn't him. It was Tommy. I mean, he's throwing out lies. He's throwing out things that she can say. Whatever, you know, she really wants, she doesn't want me going away forever, then she needs to up and do something like that. I mean, yeah, she might get in a little trouble, but she's going to get in near as much trouble as I am. And that's 300 calls. There is nothing anywhere in them that is anything indicative that he intended to take a deal, unless he convinced her not to show up, and then maybe we offered him something with probation or something else. But that would strictly be as a result of his illegal coercive tactics. And in fact, ultimately, they did succeed. She did finally get tired of the whole thing. At some point in the public defender's office, she did go in and recant. The statement Ms. Rodasta made, first of all, was never in evidence. It was never responded to, so it was officially not evidence in terms of it ever getting there. It was a question with no response. it wasn't acknowledged or not acknowledged. But having said that, the reason for that was the defense had gone describing how there were different interviews, and they at one point wanted to offer the one where the detectives came back after the refresher to come back in a trial. They had no objection to offering that as long as it wasn't offered in a vacuum. What we simply asked was that all of her statements be looked at. You want to say that, you know, the cops put the words in her mouth on this day, well, let's look at what they did at the very beginning of this case when it started long before any of this fabrication motivation came up, and let's see who did the talking then, because it was very clear that the victim was doing all of the talking back at the time. And in comparison and contrasted, it was the state's position that they were also entitled to hear the statement given to the public defender, which by contrast, Ms. Redotta speaks for a whole page in that, and the victim responds with 3 4-word answers. Fine, give it all to the jury. Our only objection was to do it in a vacuum. But having said that, she absolutely never was never admitted. Ms. Redotta wasn't saying anything about plea negotiation. What we wanted to say, what we were offering it was, is that when we never got to it because it never came in, was when the victim was faced with, you know, the best they're going to do is maybe we'll try and get a better plea deal, they're not going to dismiss this case, was a child who's coming in and telling the truth is going, what do you mean you're not going to dismiss this? I said it never happened. That's not her response. Her response was, okay, because quite frankly, she knew at the time that nobody believed her. She knew it was a bogus recant, and she didn't expect it to go anywhere. And lastly, I would just say McKenna, in the case we talk about in terms of the negotiations, is so, even then, the court found that it was not negotiation. In that particular case, we had detectives that were speaking to McKenna. They wanted to interview him regarding the murder. He declined any interview. He sends them a letter saying, I want to negotiate my case. 2 days later, he comes in and speaks directly to the police officer, pursuant to a letter that he sends to them saying, I want to negotiate my case. Even then, when you have arguably a state agency, the police officer's talking to him, even then, the court has said, that's not plea negotiation. They knew that those detectives weren't in a position to be offering anything, and therefore those statements weren't made. I thank you.
Thank you.
First, we'd like to highlight to the court the fact that many of the excerpts that were discussed here related to other phone calls, not the specific phone call that was the issue here in the brief. The primary issue with that particular phone call is that it specifically referenced that he was going to take a plea.
Counsel, let's come back to that. Was there a plea negotiation? I heard what counsel said. It was an absolute.
There was an offer.
And what we're hearing here is that your client basically says, I'm not taking that deal. Here's a deal I want to do.
We never heard him say, I'm not taking that deal. What we know is that he waived the preliminary hearing. People who unconditionally waive their preliminary hearings do so in anticipation of accepting an offer that has been placed on the table. It was a 10 to life. The state is absolutely correct about that. There was probably zero chance of him getting probation or counseling. However, we don't know exactly what he was thinking at that point. We don't know that he was going to back out of that deal. That is something that the state is assuming here, and I don't think that this court should attribute that kind of intent, that nefarious intent, when he was also, in the context of these conversations, seeking some kind of lenience at sentencing. Just as many times he would refer to the letter he wanted her to write to help him at sentencing. Why would he be discussing that had he not intended on following through with the deal? The actual evidence, aside from the aspersions cast by the state, indicates that he unconditionally waived his preliminary hearing. He did so in anticipation of not going to trial, but of taking this deal. And he waived on December 3rd. The phone call that is at issue in this case took place on December 15th, when he was speaking to his nephew and when he specifically articulated, I'm hoping to get it taken care of with the plea. That is what we find objectionable, that is what we find prejudicial, and that is what should not have come in.
That last part, prejudicial. One of the things you began to do at the beginning of this is you began to read to us the outcome of this trial and the counts that were hung and the counts that he was acquitted. the jury seemed to take everything into consideration. So how is that prejudicial when the jury was able to determine that, based on what was presented, he was not guilty of certain things, or they were, in essence, hung?
Well, if you look at the verdicts closely, what is evident is that the jury clearly did not believe or find credible every single allegation that Jay made against him. This was obviously some kind of compromise verdict where jurors felt that something had happened, but they didn't know exactly what. And two of the counts that he was convicted on had some arguable DNA evidence that may or may not have backed up her statement. However, those were the counts that he was convicted on. It's our position that these verdicts, in fact, reveal the prejudice. They manifest the prejudice because this was a close case. They didn't believe the state's theory completely. They didn't believe everything that came out of her mouth on the stand. They knew she had recanted. They knew there were other allegations that had been recanted.
And if they knew that, then why is this not just harmless?
It cannot be harmless ever for a defense attorney to face a jury during closing argument, to argue for their client's innocence, to argue for acquittal, when that jury has explicitly been told, not once, but twice, through the defendant's own words and through the mouths of his advocates, that a plea deal had been contemplated. Because jurors don't believe that innocent people take deals. Regular people cannot imagine why somebody would take any kind of a deal if they were 100% innocent.
And that seems to be where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. Did we have a deal or did we not have a deal?
We absolutely did have a deal. That's why he waived his prelim. There's no other reason why he would have done so.
You have a concluding point you'd like to leave us with?
Just to go back to the harmless error, Your Honor, it is our position that this type of error can never be harmless because it completely undermines the presumption of innocence and it completely decimates our credibility before the jury.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
We thank counsel for their arguments today, pointing out points in the record and the applicable law. This matter will stand submitted.